Welcome to the Two Daft Yanks Podcast, the show that brings you tidbits from all aspects of the soccer world. Sometimes serious, sometimes zany, always opinionated. Now, here are your hosts, Chad Smith and Corey Chatelain.
This is the Two Daft Yanks Podcast. I am your host, Chad Smith, and I'm joined by my co-host, as always, Mr. Corey Chatelain.
What an excellent intro! Oh my god, it was so great! The words just flowed! Oh!
Ah, oh, Ray Hudson, annoying!
Dude, that was a world-class Ray Hudson impression.
Oh man, I was trying to watch the end of the PSG San Etienne game a little while ago, and I had to turn it off because Ray Hudson was, you know, basically orgasming over every single pass. It was annoying.
But, the Greens won, I do believe. Is that correct?
No, PSG.
Oh, okay. Well, I saw this.
Latin brace. That's why Ray Hudson was oohing and aahing over everything, because he was loving on some Zlatan.
Oh, let's hear that. Can we hear just a quick, Zlatan love in your... I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Oh, even his shoelaces, oh my god, they're magnificent! They just glow with world-class talent!
That's beautiful. Yeah. All right, folks. Welcome to the Two Daft Yanks Podcast. Let's get to the rundown. Here is what is in store on the show this week, and we're going to focus on the games because there are just so many talking points from all the games in the top half of the table and from the bottom half as well, but we do not have the time to talk about all of them. So we're going to focus at the top because, you know, like most of you were front runners.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know. All right, so we will open the show with a Hull versus Manchester City. We will then move on to talking about Aston Villa and their victory against Chelsea. We will take a halftime intermission to give you This Week in Daftness. And then the bottom half of the show will be about Liverpool's win at Old Trafford. And then we will finish up the show with something near and dear to Corey and I's hearts. And that is the North London Derby.
Blood is red.
So, all right. So, let's get the crowd fired up and let's get going. All right, and we're going to do this in chronological order, because that's what we do here. So the early game on Saturday was Manchester City traveling to the whole Paper Tigers. I don't know, can we call them that?
Sure, why not?
The whole city Paper Tigers. And Manchester City...
sponsored by the UN.
Yes, won 2-0. And the big point from this game, Corey, was that Manchester City went down to 10 men in the 10th minute on a professional foul by Vincent Kompany, where he took down a player, last man back. And some people were crying about it because, you know, he did the thing, pull the guy down and then put your arms in the air. So, oh, I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And sure enough, the referee did make the right call because it was blatant professional foul. So City went down to 10 men, but it did not impact them much, as they still went on to win 2-0. And so, do you have anything to say about that result?
We unfortunately, I didn't see it because the early match on Saturday, when when Arsenal's not in it, that's 3:45 for me, so I'm sleeping. But yeah, just as far as the result itself, even though Man City won, Kompany being out because of the straight red, you know, for the next three games, it's going to affect them, because I think that means he misses our match. And with Kompany out, that back line may be pretty shaky, because as I'm sure everybody's seen over the last couple of weeks, the Martin Demichelis, or Demichelis, however you say his name, has been targeted by several teams. And, you know, they've been able to kind of get him into making mistakes, even though, you know, some of them haven't been able to capitalize on them. But, yeah, so hopefully that'll help us when we play them.
Okay, and I'm sure this will be cleared up in short order, but there, I have seen there is some talk already about how long of a ban he will receive. Now, since it wasn't violent conduct, there's a lot of people thinking it's just going to be a one-match ban. But it sounds like you may have heard that it could be three.
Yeah, no, I forgot until you just mentioned it. Yeah, that's true. The three-match ban, and I was going on somebody's word on Twitter, which, you know, obviously...
Well, Twitter is like the Bible, almost, right?
Yes. But yeah, I think you are correct, now that you mention it, that the three-match ban would only be for violent conduct.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to think back, now that I think about it, somebody for us, who I can't recall who it was at the moment, got a professional foul and only missed one game.
Mm-hmm. I would expect it to only be one match. And I was just talking to my city friend, and he said the same thing. But he said in their camp that there was argument. So I guess we'll find out soon. Probably tomorrow. I'll get clarified.
I think now that you mention it, though, I think you are right. I think it only will be one game.
Mm-hmm. And we'll see. But this was a pretty impressive win for City, obviously falling down to 10 men so early. Then they scored a goal just 4 minutes later. It was De Silva with the goal. And the most interesting thing is that Manchester City made no adjustments to their tactics after falling down to 10 men. You know, usually you'll throw off, you know, an attacker and put out another defender. They didn't. They stuck with their lineup for the rest of the game, and they were intent on attacking, and it paid off as they ended up with the two goals.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that's down to two things. One, obviously, City's got going to have more natural quality than Hull to begin with. So Hull's already going to be a... you know, their tactics are already going to be set up to defend anyway. So with 10 men, with City having the 10 men, you don't really have to adjust your tactics too much because, like I said, Hull, even being at home, is going to be more set up to defend anyway. And then the other thing I would probably put that down to is a lot of the Spanish and Latin managers, their secondary tactic is three at the back anyway. So, like I said, without actually having seen the match, I'm assuming that he just basically moved the two fullbacks a little more centrally when they were defending. Is that correct? I don't know. Did you...
Let me look at the average position chart.
Because, like I said, if they did, that would be my guess that, like I said, a lot of those Latin managers... their secondary tactics playing three at the back anyway.
Well, that is true, and that is a really good observation for you to bring out. So let me look at the average position chart, which I have right here. And let me just see, because sometimes they do these all crazy. There's Manchester City. No, they played as wings still. I'm looking at Zabaleta and Clichy, and they are still playing out wide.
Interesting. So they must have dropped...
They didn't really... I'm serious. They didn't change their tactics at all.
Huh. So they must have just said, well, screw it. We're going to have the ball more anyway, so don't have to defend if you got the ball, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So it was an impressive win, and that's why I say it was impressive, because they were very brave and stuck with it, and they get the win. So that is the story with Manchester City this week. And so let's move on to the real fireworks.
Yeah, and this game was definitely interesting.
And that is Aston Villa 1, Chelsea 0. And there's a trend that, and I heard this before the match, and it sounds like you heard it after the match, maybe watching Match of the Day, but the special one, Jose Mourinho, has 0 wins in his career at Villa Park. Has never won there before.
I was surprised to hear that, because you just assume that, especially when the couple years they won the title with him, that you would just assume they had beaten everybody, or you know, just had picked up a win somewhere along the way at pretty much, you know, every venue somewhere, you know, or even, you know, even in a cup match or something. So yeah, I was definitely surprised to hear that because, I mean, Villa is always fairly competitive, but you know, they, to be honest, they haven't been really that good for several years. So yeah, I was surprised to hear that.
Okay, and the big kicker there was obviously, this was, you know, right now people are getting ready for March Madness, but this was Red Card Madness.
Yes.
I guess including the whole weekend was, because you got City got carded, Chelsea got two cards, and we'll talk about more cards here in the future.
Yeah, with Vidic.
Mm-hmm. But Willian, again, professional foul. Well, it wasn't a straight red. He got a professional foul yellow. So he picked up two yellows, one in the 25th minute and one in the 68th minute. And that was highly debated. Do you think that the referee made the right call on the second yellow?
Well, from the replay, no. But if I remember correctly, the reverse replay, I think it was a case of where the angle from where the ref was, it looked like he pulled him back more than he actually did. But yeah, I mean, personally, and, you know, I mean, obviously this has a lot to do with being an Arsenal fan and you play an attacking style most of the time to begin with. But yeah, that those kind of like counterattack, those professional fouls to stop counterattacks, I definitely think that's along with diving, that's something that they need to start weeding out of the game more, especially, you know, that when they go on and on about, you know, attacking prowess and skillful play becoming more and more, you know, into the modern game. So, yeah, so I guess my point is that from the actual contact that was made, I don't think he pulled him back enough to have committed an actual foul. However, I do think that from the angle, from that reverse angle, it looked to me that the angle that the ref was at, that it looked like he, you know, he had actually pulled him back more than he did. So I guess, you know, technically the ref, you know, could have been justified in sending him off.
Okay, now.
And then, you know, Ramirez is.
Yes, I was about to mention the second sending off. There's no question about that.
Yeah, no, that, and that's Ramirez, like, I'm sure Chelsea fans are going to be all boo-hooing about it, but Ramirez, like, for all the talk we go on about, or for all the talk that we do about Stoke and people like Charlie Adam and those guys, Ramirez is the dirtiest player in the league, mainly because up until recently, most people didn't realize how dirty this dude actually is. I mean, he's the king of the tackle where you go in with the front part of your, the studs in the front part of your cleat going in, and then kind of raking on the side of the shin pads and your calf, but making it look like you're going for the ball, but knowing exactly what you're doing. He's the king of that kind of tackle. But yeah, the one on Saturday was just, it was just an awful, awful tackle, and I tweeted him as much that it was, like Pepe Docena's tackle earlier in the year for Sunderland. I forgot the announcer called it a coward's challenge. That's basically what Ramirez, that stamp on, I forgot who it was already, but yeah, that stamp, it was just a coward's tackle, because it was one where you could tell he had never had any intention to go to the ball. You know, it was born out of frustration, and it was just a two-footed stamp that it was basically, you could see in the replay that he's lining the guy up and just going, screw it, I want to hurt this dude.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we should say that in between Willian getting sent off in the 68th minute and Ramirez getting sent off at the death of the game in stoppage time, that Fabian Delph did score a goal.
Yeah, it was a pretty nice goal, too, the back heel flick.
Mm-hmm. That, in the 82nd minute, that gave Villa their 1-0 lead. But, yes, that the stamp by Ramirez is absolutely disgraceful. And you could see that he was totally, no matter what you can say, if he says otherwise, and I don't know if he has, that it wasn't on purpose. Because when you watch it in slow motion, you could tell that he's lining them up. Now, when you're jumping over something, it's your tendency to, your natural tendency is to avoid contact, you know, with the things below you. And he didn't move his feet to try to get out of the way. He was lining that guy up, and he could have broke his leg.
Well, yeah, and it's one thing, like a stamp, like to go in with one leg, but you can tell from the replay, he tries to do him with both feet. Mm-hmm. Because the way he lands his left foot, he could have easily stepped over the guy's bottom leg, even while stamping on the right. But like I said, you could tell he kind of slows that leg down, and he misses him. But like I said, you could tell he was trying to do him with both feet. And the other thing about that I wanted to say is that he had gotten away with because he didn't make contact with the guy, but. He basically tried to do the kind of tackle I was talking about before, where you go in, your ankle's on the ground, but your front studs are up. He tried to do somebody earlier, about 10 minutes before that he got sent off. So like I said, he was definitely looking to inflict some pain on somebody. And then obviously, you know, after that goal, it was basically just a case of his frustration getting the better of him. But yeah, it was such a bad challenge. I was joking on Twitter after the game, and then with you earlier, that he should get a 6-game ban, 3 for each attempted stamp. So, you know, it should be like a double red card since he tried to do him with both feet.
Well, he's definitely going to get a 3-game ban, and I would argue that it should be more.
You know, I think you could make a case where you could easily tack on another game or two, but honestly, I think he's just going to get the 3.
Yeah, and who knows? I really don't know what the inner workings of those are and the rulings of they could add games, but that was just despicable because that guy was in a vulnerable position. Let's just say if Roger Goodell was the commissioner of the EPL,
yeah,
Ramirez would be in a lot of trouble.
Well, yeah. In fact, the Saints might actually get fined for that tackle.
Just
by proxy.
Ramirez was part of the New Orleans Saints bounty program.
Yeah, some kind of, like, he's got a Saints T-shirt. Oh, just fine him anyway. Thanks, Goodell.
All right, and in the Ramirez melee, Jose Mourinho was sent off as well.
Yeah, and that guy, all I tried to do, you tell me why you send me off. All I tried to do was ask the ref a question. Yeah, mm-hmm. By stepping on the field for 5 yards.
So we don't know, have we heard, does he face a touchline ban in the next match, possibly? Or does that go down to some review?
No, when you get sent off as a manager, it's not actually, because they call it being sent off, but it's not like... it's not the same thing as getting a red card sent off.
And that's why I'm
because and that's why they, like, when you hear the announcers call it, they it's actually being called sent to the stands. You're not actually sent off, because when you're sent off, you actually have to go to the locker room. You can't be on the field or, you know, in the proximity of the field. So he's not going to face a touchline ban, at least for that. Now, he may get some sort of fine or something for being on the field, because, again, I mean, Mourinho's the master of that stuff. He knew exactly what he was doing by stepping on the field and kind of causing a scene. And then he may have to face some sort of disciplinary hearing for his I'm not saying anything, but I'm saying something comments after the game, too. But, yeah, as far as the getting sent to the stands, he won't be banned.
Yes, let's get into that. His post-game that he gave with either the Sky or the BBC, I think it was the BBC because that's where I think I watched it, was very, very curious. I do believe that he should be punished for what he said, because he sits there and says, well, I don't want to say anything that's going to get me in trouble. But the referee knew what he was doing for 90 minutes. And then they asked him, well, what do you mean by that? And he's like, oh, no, I mean that he did a very fine job, and he's a very well-qualified referee. So he took that little jab, like, trying to say, oh, he's trying to get us on purpose. And mind you, this is just a week after Chelsea got a game broken open when a ref gave them a bogus red card and penalty. But you'll never hear him complain about that.
Yeah, or the bogus penalty against West Brom back in October or whatever, or September.
Mm-hmm. So do you... And that's why Mourinho, he's the king of these mind games. But let me just... This is something that I blogged about a few weeks ago, and he's adamant that, oh, we're not title contenders. And do you think... I think that his attitude or the way he's handling this situation is detrimental to his club, because if he wants to think so or not, they are title contenders, and perhaps if he would stress that to his team, they would have these better performances where they're not dropping points against teams that they shouldn't. So do you think that maybe his laid-back attitude, where he's not trying to put pressure on them, is actually having the reverse effect to where they're not really trying hard enough?
Yeah, I don't know, because that's a case where it's... you know, obviously you're taking comments that he's making to the public, and then, you know, comments on the training ground or in the locker room may be completely different. So, you know, he may be having, you know, a PR party line, and then, you know, like I said, in the training ground, you know, he's cracking the whip, or, you know, he's more forthright with the players, saying, you know, that we are contenders or something.
No, it's possible.
So, again, and that's the thing with Mourinho is, you know, like I even saw somebody joke on Twitter after the game that maybe getting sent off and losing to Aston Villa is just one giant mind game. So like I said, that's, you know, which, you know, I mean, obviously it sounds a little ridiculous and funny, but like I said, with Mourinho, it is one of those, maybe everything is just one giant mind game to him, so you never really know. I mean, I'm not trying to say that he wanted to lose to Villa, but just meaning all his interactions with the press, you know, if I'm not saying they're not all like 100% deliberate and planned, but I definitely think there is a method to everything he does or everything he says to the press. Mm-hmm. And everything is basically boils down to putting the spotlight on him and away from whatever the result of Chelsea is, especially when they lose, to where... So I guess my point is that kind of what you said about not necessarily being laid back and not thinking they're title contenders, but that's how he's relieving the pressure on the players, is that we're constantly making the spotlight on you know, the press talk about him, and then, you know, less on you know, Chelsea's performances, and especially their, you know, their poor performances or losses like on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a fair point, and it's working, obviously. But this got me to something just off the wall. You know, it wouldn't surprise me, you know, like after World War II, and like many years ago now, after then, it leaked out that, you know, all these stars and all these like sports people were like working for the CIA, like covertly. It wouldn't surprise me if we find out, like, after he retires that Mourinho's a CIA agent.
Yeah, no, it definitely wouldn't surprise me, because, like I said, it's everything with him is definitely one big mind game. It's just, because, like I said, it's just Mourinho strikes me as the kind of guy who, even when, you know, when you would go to give him praise, he would act humble, but not because he's humble, just because he wants to hear you continually praise him and pump him up. Because, like I said, everything is just one big giant mind game with the guy.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. So Chelsea cannot get it done at Aston Villa, and they've opened up the door for some of the teams and clubs that we'll talk about in the second half of the show. But first, let's get some music cranked up, Mr. Corey, for This Week in Daftness.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Now, This Week in Daftness has a runaway leader, but it would be too obvious. I mean, we could go on and on about the exploits of one Nicholas Bentner, but we will spare you from that, because, you know, that gets a little on the PG-13 side, if not more.
Well, R-rated if you're a cab.
Yeah. Assault, yeah. Sexual assault of a cab.
Yeah.
Anyway, the focus this week in Daphnis is one Warren Barton. And oh boy, did he put his foot in his mouth. This comes from worldsoccertalk.com earlier in the week. And let me just read you this quote. "I think Gus Johnson is as good as anybody in the world. Yes, Martin Tyler is the benchmark, but you got to give Gus 15 to 20 years in the game, and he's right behind him. I'm a big fan. Not just because he's with us, but for what he does with the game. How strong he is to put his reputation on the line to do that. That takes not only guts, but it takes confidence to do that, and he's got all our confidence and the network behind him." Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Where do we ever be? How daft of a statement is that? Now, I understand that, obviously, he works for Fox, and he's got to say things like that. But to say that he's right there with Martin Tyler in terms of calling a soccer match is absolutely so beyond daft that my daft brain can't even comprehend it.
Yeah, because I guarantee you give Martin Tyler just a month of an American sport, and he would be up there with the best announcers in, whatever, the NBA, the NFL, much less this crap about, oh, well, Gus Johnson needs a couple years to get up to speed.
No, he said 15 to 20.
Well, but what I'm... But right, but...
15
but just
to
meaning
years.
His actual experience in calling games...
No, I got you.
What's it been? 2-3 years? And like I said, he still sounds like he doesn't know what's going on half the time. Or, he still slips up with the fast break. The basketball reference crap.
Yeah.
So like I said, I guarantee you somebody like Martin Tyler, you give him just a month or two, and he's going to be up there with some of the better announcers, regardless of the sport. Because, like I said, what makes Martin Tyler so good is he's not just an announcer. He's somebody that's, he would have been a good orator to begin with, much less an announcer. Like I said, it happens to be that he's an announcer, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that Martin Tyler would be an outstanding baseball announcer.
Yes, because especially how he, unlike Mike Emmerich in the NHL, where his anecdotes kind of ramble on over the play, Martin Tyler is very good with the anecdotal stuff, but making the anecdotes relevant to what's going on with the play, not just anecdotes for anecdotes' sake, kind of like Mike Emmerich does, where they just kind of ramble. But yeah, so that style would be really good, like you said, in baseball, where you have all the, 30 seconds in between pitches and everything, and you have all that air, that dead air to fill.
Okay.
Could you imagine Martin Tyler opposite Harry Carey doing a baseball game? That would have been awesome.
Jeez.
Or the Bob Uecker.
The two styles are so different. It would be
Or Bob Uecker.
Yeah. It'd be pretty funny. All right, let's get back on point here and this Gus Johnson stuff. Now, here's the bad news. The article, according to World Soccer Talk, they say there's a big PR blitz, and they are speculating that Gus Johnson will be back calling the rest of the Champions League games when leagues after the next round here comes up, after this week, I guess, because we still have some more games. So when the next round takes place in April, they are speculating that Gus Johnson will be back because by then, mind you, his American college basketball duties will be over with and he'll be free again to call soccer matches. So how can Fox have a guy who is calling college football games and college basketball games during the season, pluck him right, throw him right back into the fire, calling soccer matches? Doesn't he need to be calling soccer matches all year if they're serious about him as a soccer announcer going forward?
Well, that's to me, that's part of the joke of, or one of the things that makes Fox kind of a joke. And, you know, little things like that, why they ended up losing, you know, the EPL contract, because it's, to them, it's all, to them, it's just a TV production. It's, or, you know, the mechanics of a TV production. They don't get the experience of the TV production of soccer, if that makes sense, where kind of like what we talked about, where NBC does such a good job, at least in comparison to Fox, is they understand that a lot of the hardcore EPL fans in the U.S. are similar in nature to the fans overseas, that it's more than a game. It's about the culture of the, or, you know, it's more than just a viewer sport that you're watching. It's more of a cultural experience. It's more, you know, of a fan experience beyond just watching the game. And like I said, I think that's where Fox continually drops the ball, is that they just, like everything else, they're trying to pigeonhole it into an American broadcast type of experience where you're basically just a fan watching a game, and that they don't get that, you know, they don't get that kind of relevance or that kind of secondary experience. What makes hardcore fans like soccer, you know, beyond the sport part of it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So in short, Warren Barton, you're daft.
Yeah.
Get off my TV,
you Newcastle wanker.
Jeez. So it just breaks my heart that they're telling me that Gus is probably coming back. So get your mute buttons ready. Mute button.
Yeah, well I'll say, well, it'll be fully muted because Arsenal's out, so I won't even be watching. Whoa!
Oh, boy.
People will have to update me on Gus Johnson's progress.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah, or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm. All right. That was halftime. Now let's get back into the games here. There's been no changes at halftime, by the way. We're happy with the way we're playing. The podcast is going smoothly.
Yeah,
we
no
do have
sucks.
Some. We do have some wide players warming up. We might need a little more width. So the wieners are out, you know, stretching, jogging. But let's get into one of our favorite topics, and that is Manu Schadenfreude. Manchester United was defeated at Old Trafford by Liverpool, and again, people are shocked.
Yeah.
Man U losing at home yet again, and people are shocked. Why? Why are they shocked?
Because apparently Liverpool got all of the penalties for like the next decade at Old Trafford.
That is true. They got a decade's worth of penalties in one game. One match.
Yeah, what'd they get, like 8 or 9 or something? It was crazy.
No, there's 3.
Okay.
And Gerrard buried the first 2. And the third one, he hit right off the post. And that would have been a history-making moment. He would have been the first player in Premier League history to score a hat trick on penalties.
Yeah, they were talking about it on the North London Derby that it had been done before and by a Liverpool player, but it was in the pre-EPL era by Jan Molby.
In a League Cup match, I do believe they said.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. So Steven Gerrard is your penalty-taking hero. 2 out of 3 times, at least.
Yeah, he's a meatloaf penalty taker. 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
And to be fair, one of the penalties was a complete dive by Daniel Sturridge.
Oh. When an English player dives, you got to say his name like a French person, because English people don't dive, says Daniel Sturridge.
There we go. Yes. The French. Yeah. He was French that day.
Yes.
Or today. And I'm sure France would take him on their team, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
Maybe it's hard to say. But, no, there's another point I wanted to make. And I was looking at the box score here. But I already forgot, so that's okay. But let's just talk about when Man U runs into these problems. It's always funny to me to where pretty much every week the one of the commentators has to invoke the name of Roy Keane. Yeah. And I got moves for you, Manchester United and Manchester United sympathizers. Roy Keane ain't walking down that tunnel.
Yeah, now are you talking about, like, replacement for Moyes or just in general about the whole
about they
the
need
club
a,
spirit and everything?
They need a player like him.
Yeah, so it's...
They're saying it's always, we need a rough and tumble, you know, blood and guts type of player in there.
Yeah, the kind of player that is on record admitting he tried to break somebody's leg once.
Yes, that is true.
But it's Arsenal's that was dirty, remember?
Mm-hmm. And that's another point I want to make. Now they call and cry for him, a player of that ilk or that type, to come in. But think, in today's climate, if Roy Keane was still playing, now maybe if he was still playing for Man U, he'd get ran out of the game otherwise. But maybe not, because, you know, obviously he'd have things going for him where he's not foreign. He's plays for Man U. And so maybe they would sweep it under the rug. But I just find it very interesting that in a team that the reason why Manchester United isn't very good is not because they lack the blood and guts. It's because they lack the technical ability.
Well, that and they're a perfect example of the difference between, or at least without Ferguson, because again, Ferguson was where Mourinho's the master of mind games. Ferguson was the master of, you know, getting the best out of players and getting them into a team. But like I said, Man U is a perfect example of the difference between having a bunch of individuals that are talented versus having a bunch of individual talent that's molded into a team. You know, kind of like they're in fifth or sixth place right now, but the best overall team I've seen this year that plays knowing their roles is actually Everton. But like I said, that's where Man U, without Ferguson, has kind of lost their way. And again, maybe you can put that down to Moyes, although I think in a case like Man U, I don't think all of it has to do with Moyes, because you have such, you know, giant egos at a club like Man U. But like I said, that's where I think Man U has problems, is that you kind of get guys playing in groups or units rather than an actual full team these days.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly taking place, it looks like to me.
And or units meaning like cliques.
Yeah, no, I understand what you mean. And now here's just looking at the home form table. Manchester United ranks only 9th in the league in home form. They played 14 matches at Old Trafford, and they are 6-3-5. So just think about that. They have 6 wins and 5 losses in this season.
Well, I was going to say that was either their 5th or 6th loss at home.
That's their 5th loss at home this year.
And that's just in the league.
And that's just in the league. That is correct.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something that's, you know, I mean, some of us were predicting that Man U was going to fall off. I mean, much to the surprise and delighted surprise, I should say, that, you know, we didn't think, myself included, we didn't think they were going to fall off that much. But yeah, like I said, I just keep coming back to, it just shows what or how damn good of a manager Ferguson actually was, because, you know, they didn't overhaul that team too much over the last few years, and especially after Ronaldo left, they've had more or less the same core players, and just how average they look now at times compared to, you know, even last year where they kind of ran away with the title.
Mm-hmm. And with this loss, where they were really never in the game, they didn't look threatening very often. I think we've turned a corner, and on NBC today, they openly called for Moyes to be replaced.
Yeah, because that's definitely what's weird about watching Man U now is that, you know, in the past when they would lose, it was always, you know, even when they didn't get their Fergie time goal, there was just that inevitable wave of attack that you always had to worry about from Man U, where now, outside of Rooney, it just seems like they just go through these long periods where they don't play like a team, they don't look good, and then at times it's almost like they, not that they lack determination, but that they look defeated at times, which for a Man U club is just, you know, as long as I've been watching EPL, I've never seen that before. Like I said, it's weird to actually see Man U looking defeated now in several games, not just, you know, today or you know, recently. So it's just completely bizarre.
Mm-hmm. We are living in strange times, folks.
Yes, may you live in strange times, Man U. The ancient Chinese curse.
Mm-hmm.
Or interesting times, sorry. All right.
Yeah. So we'll see. So now I think when the media starts saying, hey, should this guy be in charge? They were even talking about him resigning. They're saying it would probably be best for him to resign, like now, they were talking. Like, not in the summer, but like now.
Well, yeah, because with a 6-year contract and being Ferguson's handpicked successor, that's the only way they're going to get rid of him. Because if they fire him, they're going to have to be on the hook for that, you know, for the next 5 years paying him. So the only way out is to try and get him to resign.
Mm-hmm. And I've been on the record saying that's how I think it will play out. I've said it many times on here.
Yeah, no, and I meant to tell you before, too, that I even saw an article, I don't remember if it was this morning or yesterday, that, and where it was, but that Moyes was quoted as saying that he didn't think... No, what it exactly said? It said he didn't expect. He knew it was going to be a tough job, but he didn't realize that managing Man U was going to be that tough. So I think that's kind of the first shot in what you're saying that that's the first piece of groundwork for him resigning in the summer.
Well, he may not be resigned, but he will be resigned, and they'll work out a nice little deal to where they give him some money.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, it'll definitely be a, you know, on the record, it'll be a resignation, but behind doors, it's basically a, you know, leave or we'll find a way to get rid of you without, you know, mm-hmm. paying for the 5 years.
But I hope I'm wrong, and I hope they keep him for the length of the contract.
You know, I hope they do, too, especially if they play like this all 6 years. Hire Bob Bradley.
It'd be glorious.
Yeah, FM, you know, football manager. He's got him in first place, finally, after 5 years.
All right. Let's get to this to end the show.
Yeah.
And this is basically going to be my therapy session. But today was another edition of the North London Derby. I thought, overall, it was a pretty entertaining and a well-played match. It had everything that you'd like to see in a derby. And Arsenal won 1-0 at White Hart Lane, scoring quickly in the second minute.
1 minute and 12 seconds.
And it was by Rosicky. Right? Thomas Rosicky scored the goal?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very good strike. And from there, Arsenal just kind of sat back and soaked up the pressure. The final possession time was 60-40 in favor of Spurs.
Yeah, and it felt more like 70-30.
Mm-hmm. And kind of leading the back line, and I think you've talked about this guy many times, and I haven't, I'll have to look up who scored here while I say this, just to see if they agree, but just from my first look and watching the game, not looking at any stats yet, Koscielny played absolutely amazing.
Yeah, who scored had Koscielny as the man of the match. Okay. My man of the match was actually Mertesacker.
I see a 9.2 rating from whoscored.com as well.
But yeah, I mean, either one, you couldn't go wrong with picking men of the match for that. Because, yeah, I joked on Twitter that Murdersacker should be employed by NASA as Earth defense for asteroids, because the dude just clears everything.
Okay, now his rating is boosted, and I'm trying to... And here's why. So this is why he's got a 9.2. And I'm struggling to remember. They're saying he had a clearance off the line?
Yeah, that goal line clearance of...
What did that happen?
Early in the second half, when I think it was Chadley, where he tried to dribble...
Oh, yeah. I guess that technically is a goal line clearance, true.
Yeah, because the goalkeeper was stranded, yeah, so it was basically Murdersacker and Koscielny.
Chesney made a complete mess of that.
Yeah.
And we let him off the hook. Spurs did. I shouldn't say we, but Spurs let him off the hook. And then Koscielny was also credited with a last-man tackle.
Yeah, that was on Soldado at the end. Okay. Or, I'm sorry, Adebayor near the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I remember that now. So
yeah, because it's actually top of the box.
Mm-hmm.
But
so Arsenal played well, but the problem for
played well defensively.
Yes, the problem for Tottenham going forward and defensively is 100% down to Tim Sherwood and his lack of tactics. So let's have Chaz's little tactical breakdown here, folks. Oh man. And I got to keep this short because there's so many things. But here's the simplest thing I can say. Now, there's a reason why teams usually don't sack their managers mid-season. And usually when they do, you know, they bring somebody in who kind of, you know, cobbles together, kind of sticks with the same philosophy.
Or similar, yeah.
Or similar philosophy. But with Sherwood, there is no philosophy. He started 4-4-2. Sometimes we play 4-3-3. Sometimes it's 4-2-3-1. Sometimes it's 4-4-1-1. There's no consistency, and there's no clear message from week to week. The lineups are picked out from a hat, I swear, at times.
Yeah, because I think who scored even had him technically lined up in a 4-5-1 or something.
Yes, and we'll get to this. Now, the problem is, on the left side of the pitch, you got Danny Rose, who, for all purposes, is actually a left wing, who's been converted to left back, but he's not very good. And to compound that problem, you put one of the world's best young number 10s out wide at left in Christian Eriksen, which leaves that whole left flank open, because the problem is, in the days under AVB, Spurs played a high line, and the fullbacks were encouraged to press forward. But the problem is now, the left back we still play a high line at times for whatever reason, and the left back still bomb forward. But the problem is, when you have Christian Eriksen, who is more than likely going to drift inside because he's more comfortable in the middle, and the fullbacks are pressing forward left, well, you give yourself tons of space. And that's exactly what Rosicky took advantage of for his goal. Danny Rose was a good 30 yards back from the play because he was so far ahead. I don't even know what the hell he was doing. He was so far away from the ball.
Well, yeah, because even on the opportunity that Chamberlain blew...
Same situation.
The guy he beats on the dribble is actually one of the midfielders that dropped back into... Not quite the left back spot, but it was in that left. It was in the channel in between where the fullback and the center back would have been. Because as you said, Rose had already been upfield. So like I said, the guy Chamberlain's actually beating to get on the breakaway was actually one of the midfielders. I think it was Sandro.
Mm-hmm. So the problem is when you do this, you leave the other team to hit you on the counter with just one simple pass, and they're free with either a 3-on-2 situation or a 2-on-1 situation. And that's how Spurs have given up a lot of these goals, and any manager worth anything would have had this fixed by now. You got to tell the fullbacks have to hold. You can't just bomb forward at will anymore. You need to have some defensive positioning discipline. And so that's either on the player... If the player doesn't understand the concept, then he should be benched. But I think the problem is, I'm not sure if Sherwood even understands that concept or not, because he's just one of these gung-ho English tactics, you know, get the ball forward type of guys.
Yeah, and I think that's, I think you hit the nail on the head, is that, like, and I think even Graham Lasso made a comment during the broadcast, kind of along the same lines, talking about Sherwood and the 4-4-2, that the way he sets it up, you know, as we've talked about on this show before, regardless of what formation you're running, it's really about how you apply that and how much work rate, you know, and determination, et cetera, that you put in. But that in modern football, there are certain formations that do put you positionally at a bad start to begin with, which in England is generally the 4-4-2 these days, because you're already being outnumbered in midfield, because most people, you know, put the 3 or the 5 in midfield now. So just meaning that, like you were saying, when you compound that with your fullbacks going forward, now you only have the two people in midfield, because both your wide midfielders and your fullbacks are trying to get forward, and you're basically isolating 3-on-2 in two different locations in the midfield, and then, as you said, if they play that quick ball over the top or out wide, now you're 2v1 versus each fullback, you know, obviously depending on what's, or not fullback, each center back, depending on which you know, side of the field you're going to. Because yeah, just the way he sets it up, the only way I could see it working is if with the ball you almost drop both of your center midfielders to play like just in front of the center backs, to where they can kind of cover out wide, you know, to compensate for those fullbacks getting forward. But again, even doing that, you're going to leave the midfield wide open.
Which may not be a problem, and let me get to my next point. So then going forward, now for whatever reason, he's in love with the inverted wieners, too.
Yeah.
And I never understand that. I don't like the inverted wings with just one guy up top. And then when your game plan is to pump in crosses into the box, and Spurs had 32, I do believe, which is a high number, they only completed 6 or 7, because the problem is when you play inverted wings, it's hard for them to cross when they're not on their natural foot.
Yeah, and inverted wingers work best when they're flip-flopping constantly during the game, because it gives each of those fullbacks, they got to worry about both. They got to worry about crosses and cutting inside. When you play inverted wingers the entire game, the fullbacks know that 99% of the time they got to come inside.
So now you're seeing why people do not sack their manager midseason without a plan, because then you end up with people like Tim Sherwood, and he's acted very unprofessional on the touchline in his press conferences. Ripped this off from Twitter. This is great. One of my people I follow said, Sherwood's not full of, you know, character and guts like he's asking his team to play. He's completely unprofessional because he's not qualified to be in the job that he's in.
Yeah, it's almost like he's daring Levy to fire him at this point.
And I think
with some of his antics.
I mean, at this point in time, the season's over, and it was over when. And I've been on this bandwagon since day one. If you fire AVB, that's fine. AVB deserved to be fired, deserved to be sacked. But you better have a plan in place instead of putting someone in who has never coached at anything above the youth level and taking over. Because Spurs have a talented squad. Even as bad as things are, we're still in fifth place, comfortably in fifth place, with all the disaster that has happened, injuries, you know, sacking a manager. So it's interesting.
Well, yeah, because even today, you know, obviously we won the game, but y'all were by far the better, or the team who played by far better overall.
And you could say that, but I don't really.
Well, but just meaning that.
Maybe.
You know, that as you said, the talent is definitely there. It's just a matter of molding it into a team, kind of like what we're talking about,
yeah,
Man U.
But you see this? I mean, Sherwood says, hey, we outplayed Arsenal. Okay, well, it doesn't matter. We didn't score a goal, so it doesn't really matter. Sherwood, here's another headline. Sherwood says there needs to be patience. Dude, you're going to be gone in May. May, I think the season ends like May 12th, I think I saw.
I believe that's correct.
This clown better be sacked like May 13th, or if not that night.
Yeah.
Because you see these articles leaking where
sack him on the way back to the locker room.
Where he's talking about, oh yeah, me and Levy are already planning our off-season plans, and I'm like, oh God forbid if this guy's actually still in charge come summer. Oh.
I'm just gonna put this out there, Sherwood. If you see Fredo in the boat while you're fishing, you're screwed.
Yeah. So, all right. No, I'm sorry. That segment didn't go as good as I wanted to, but I hope we highlighted some things that have bugged Tottenham. It seems like Sherwood has started playing the same tactics that AVB used that got him sacked. It's just insane.
Yeah, that definitely... y'all definitely need to reconsider that. Because, again, it's one thing to play with a high line, but y'all play with such a high line that it's just asking for trouble playing the 4-4-2 with, you know, with not having that extra person in midfield.
Well, we were in a four. There was only one striker today. But it's it's so high, you're basically taking – a lot of the times you're taking your two wings and your fullbacks out of defensive duties because they're so high.
Yeah.
So that's the problem. You're left to where you got your two center backs and maybe, if you're lucky, one central midfielder who's able to get back in time. So, oh boy. So there you go.
Yeah, and on my end, I just, you know, I hope he gets the Moyes treatment. A 5-year extension for Sherwood. Sherwood in forever!
Yeah, maybe those two can take charge of some, like, League One side over the summer together.
Yeah.
Maybe between the two of them, you could put together a competent manager.
Or, yeah, whatever the club they start when the when Hull or the Cardiff fans break off, you know, when their Asian owners run them off, they could go manage that club.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's just take a look at this table really quickly. Chelsea's kind of left the door open for people. They've played 30 games. They're on 66 points. Liverpool's just 4 back, but have a game in hand. Arsenal at 62, just a game back, or just a 4 points back with a game in hand as well. And then you have Manchester City, 6 points back with 3 games in hand. So the title race is wide open.
Yeah, because we play Chelsea next week, and they're going to be missing Willian and Ramirez.
Yeah, so any of the 4 teams in the top 4 could win the title if things go their way.
So the way it's shaping up now, I think if I had to bet on a team, I might bet on Liverpool right now.
It's kind of scary, huh?
Yeah, even though I wouldn't want to have their back line over a full season personally. But yeah, the way things are going now, like I said, I think if you forced me to bet, I would bet on Liverpool, I think.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It changes from the week to week. So, it's just crazy. And in the bottom's coming a little more clear. I think Fulham and Cardiff are both in serious trouble. I can't foresee them playing well enough to stay up. So, you just got that one spot at the bottom, which is currently held by Sunderland. But they have 2 games on hand and 3 games on hand on some teams in this relegation battle at 25 points. And Sunderland got an important point over the weekend. And then you got Crystal Palace on 28, West Brom at 28.
And I think one of those games Sunderland has in hand is against Crystal Palace or one of their direct relegation rivals.
Yes, one of them for sure is Sunderland Crystal Palace. So the bottom is going to be really interesting. And you have this case where you have West Brom, who fired their manager, have been dragged into the relegation battle. Should have kept Clark. And
yeah,
Swansea are now in the mix. Swansea are only 4 points up. And Sunderland has 2 games in hand on Swansea as well. So, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in these last, you know, 8 to 10 games, depending on what club you are.
Yeah, because just going back to the top of the table for a second, Liverpool, in some form or another, is going to decide who wins the title, because Chelsea and Man City still have to go to Anfield. And I think we don't play them, but Liverpool also plays either Spurs or somebody else. So just meaning that there's going to be a bunch of big games in the next few weeks at Anfield. And I think, like I said, Liverpool is going to decide the title. And, you know, it may not be them winning it, but they're going to have the biggest say on who wins it, I think.
Okay. Here I got their fixtures right in front of me. They do host Tottenham, but Tottenham is out of it, out of the top four race altogether, as far as I'm concerned. Liverpool also hosts Manchester City, and they host Chelsea. So they're at home for Tottenham, Man City, and Chelsea, which is interesting. And then just for future reference, they close the season at home against Newcastle. So there you go.
And then City's got to play, still has to play us, Chelsea, Liverpool, and Man United, which even though Man United's probably not going to get into Europe now, which again you called several weeks ago, congratulations there. but that, you know, the Manchester Derby, you know, obviously you're not going to be able to write that game off. So Man City's got four huge games left. So like I said, I think, if I had to bet now, I would actually bet on Liverpool.
Yeah, I'm not going to bet anymore because I keep making a fool of myself. But actually, I've been pretty constant with the Chelsea. But I don't like the way, as we mentioned before, the way Mourinho is approaching this. And I think his mind games are actually working against his own club. So they're not the clear favorites anymore. It's wide open.
Yeah, because it seems this year Mourinho's mind games have more to do with being almost selfish instead of actually helping the club like they used to, or, you know, continually helping the club like they used to. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, he's not trying to do that, but like I said, especially in the last few weeks, the mind game stuff has just come off more as him being selfish rather than helping the club.
Mm-hmm, and I agree that he's doing this just in case they do slip up, so then he can't be blamed in the end for not reaching their objectives, in quotes. Would you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, although with, like I said, with I don't know if what the end goal of that would be, because with somebody like Abramovich, you never know, you know, not winning the title, whether you're going to be able to stay around anyway. I mean, look at Di Matteo, won the damn Champions League for him, and an FA Cup in the same year, and still got the sack.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've been blabbing on about that for far too long, but let's just hit quickly what we have midweek Champions League. These are all second legs. Chelsea's hosting Galatasaray. Real Madrid is hosting Schalke. Borussia Dortmund will be hosting Zenit, who have rumoredly hired AVB.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's true, but that's what the current Porto manager, Jesus, says. And then the highly anticipated Manchester United will be hosting Olympiacos, where they need to overturn, is that a two-goal deficit?
Yeah, two goals.
Two-goal deficit at home. So, we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, two-goal deficit and coming off a butt-whooping of Liverpool. It's not looking good for them.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. So, enjoy the Champions League footy. Be sure to check out the blog throughout the week. We will be talking about all of this. And we will be back next week to talk about what has occurred since then.
Ray Hudson out.
This has been the Two Daft Yanks podcast. If you like the show, be sure to find the Yanks at TwoDaftYanks.com or at Two Daft Yanks on Twitter. There, you can stay up to date on all the Two Daft Yanks action by subscribing to the show.